Hello, my name's Jordan Marr, and this is Farming in British Columbia, a podcast that hopes the fruit trees are okay. This episode is about the ramifications for farmers of BC's ongoing drought. You're going to hear from two people. One of them is Tom Walker.
Yeah, so I have a part-time retirement gig with writing for the agriculture newspaper Country Life in BC. It's the only ag news in the province. We have something like 10,000 subscribers. I have the luxury of perhaps doing what I always wanted to do, is talk and write about government and political things. I have a degree in political science from a long, long time ago, and I have a minor in resource management, and it's stuff I like to talk about, and I like to write about it.
The other is Nathan Cullen, BC's Minister of Water, Land, and Natural Resources.
Sure, what am I going to do later today? I'm going to go to a bunch of Zoom meetings, and then after that, I'm going to go to some more Zoom meetings, and then I'm going to go to bed.
Much of BC has experienced various stages of drought in the last few years, with each successive year of drought compounding the issue of water scarcity in numerous parts of the province. In some areas, water scarcity in 2023 led to tensions among different water users. One example is Westwold, a small town in the Thompson-Okanagan region dominated by large ranches and forage operations. Many of those operations source their irrigation water from deep aquifers in the Salmon River watershed. Last summer, water levels in the Salmon River got so low that the ability of salmon to spawn became a concern. Because of this concern, farmers in the region were abruptly told by BC government officials to curtail their irrigation at a really crucial time of the production season. This created a lot of anger in the community. Some farmers demanded to see the science that proves that drawing water from 200 feet underground meaningfully affects water levels in the river, because they don't believe there's a connection. Things will probably get worse. We're headed into the 2024 farming season with a pretty low snowpack in many parts of the province. And meanwhile, mid-March brought warm weather that shattered a lot of temperature records. So I invited Tom Walker to talk to me, since in his gig as a writer for Country Life magazine, he's been covering the issue of water scarcity for a few years now. I also reached out to the BC Ministries of Agriculture and also Water, Land, and Resource Stewardship for comment. Specifically, I asked if I could speak to a hydrologist who could explain the relationship between drawing irrigation water from deep wells in Westwold and water levels in the Salmon River. They told me maybe, but so far I haven't confirmed an interview. But they did allow me to interview Minister Cullen for 10 minutes. You'll hear from him after my conversation with Tom Walker. I think that will suffice as an intro to this episode, other than to clarify that Tom and I use the acronym WALRUS to refer to BC's Ministry of Water, Land, and Resource Stewardship. Everybody does that, actually. Here's my conversation with Tom Walker. So the audience will know that you're a writer at Country Life, but can you bring us into how you got interested in the specific topic of, you know, water management in the province as it applies to agriculture and drought in general? Like, how long have you been paying attention to those topics?
In the spring of 2016, the government brought in the Water Sustainability Act. And at the BC Cattlemen's AGM, which was probably one of the first AGMs that I went to getting back into writing as the part-time gig that I do in my retirement, someone from the water branch stood up in front of the cattlemen and spent an hour explaining to them they were going to have to go and license their wells. And that person handed out a 96-page handout. And the terror in the room was palpable. And that's probably where my interest started. And I've been following it. And of course, water is an issue for cattlemen because you can't have cows without water. You can have grass without water, but you can't put cows on that grass. So it's something that's been in my mind. I tend to follow cattle for the paper. It's been in my mind for a long time.
Can you talk about the well establishment or well regulation landscape leading up to 2016 that brought about the Water Sustainability Act?
Well, one of the problems was that it wasn't regulated. Other provinces have. It's the old saying of it, that you can't manage what you don't measure. So if we have no idea how many wells are on the province, we can't do any forms of regulation or any forms of form of management. They expect there are 20,000 groundwater wells that have been built and or registered. So When a well driller drills a well, he registers it for you, and there's a date that the well has been drilled. But of course, years ago, that didn't even happen. But that doesn't mean it's licensed. So what the government had to do on top of the registration system was put in a licensing system, and then that gives them the ability to also charge for the water use and to track the volume that you have. But Saskatchewan were the first in Canada to license their groundwater, and that happened in 59. Ontario did it in 61. Alberta and Manitoba did it in 62. Newfoundland in 88, and Quebec in 2004. So we were the last of the party.
Right. And the basic concept is you could easily, even if there were many long periods when it wasn't a scarce resource, you can imagine it becoming one. And to be able to manage a scarce resource, you have to keep track of who's using it and in what quantities.
Yes, exactly. And it's in some ways like the fire situation in the province. We've been known this is getting worse. We've been known we've had difficulties. We've been looking at watersheds where there's been low water levels for years, and we've looked at the danger it is to fish. And now we're doing curtailment.
So I actually was at a meeting recently, a water meeting, where there were some ministry civil servants present, ag ministry, walrus ministry civil servants present. And I don't think I'm mixing up the numbers. A hydrologist that was present suggested that before the Sustainability Act, you could pump something like 1,200 gallons a minute, and the province had nothing to say about it. So there was she was making the point there was a limit.
Yes,
but it was
yes.
A very large limit. So as long as you weren't exceeding that limit, no one was keeping track.
Nobody's managing the house at all.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so then let's kind of transition into just talking about the fact that. Whatever, 6-7 years on from when the act started to require people to change behaviors, we're in a period of at least relative scarcity to what we've been used to, at least
yes.
A short-term period. Is
yes,
that a fair way to put it?
Yes.
Do you want to add detail to that?
The last government workshop I was at, they said last year was a 100-year drought.
Okay. And but we can even go back a year or two before that where yes. We started to feel, because it's kind of a compounding set of effects.
It has been a compounding set of circumstances.
Right. Yeah. So then maybe the way that we'll approach this is just to talk about last year, maybe around Westwold. I'm going to lay out some context. You tell me, because you know more than me if I'm incorrect in any major way. But essentially we got towards salmon spawning season last year on the Salmon River. And the water levels became a great concern. They were quite low, such that the people in charge of ensuring, or at least doing their best to ensure that the salmon can spawn, were greatly concerned. This would have been Minister of Walrus, right?
So no, it would have been forestry.
Oh, okay.
And it actually goes back to the year before. So in the summer of 2022, we had some of the same occurrence, but not to the extent that it was. So there were curtailments on the Salmon River in 2022 mm-hmm. as well, before this year. And to be fair for the government, they were looking at April, May, June, and July, looking at the scarcity of water already. And they did put out what they are voluntary reduction notices. Mm-hmm. Asking.
Now, are we talking about 2023 now?
Yes, 2023.
Okay.
So water is low, things are warm and dry. Can you please volunteer to reduce your water consumption wherever possible?
Mm-hmm.
So the first request is 30% and the second request is 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some forewarning.
Yeah.
But what they have not done in my opinion, is the area of difficulty, is they haven't sat down with producers and said, look, it's the beginning of August, there's no rain in the forecast, there's a bunch of salmon sitting out in the Shuswap Lake,
mm-hmm.
we know what's going to happen, how can we work together to build something to coordinate anything to make this less onerous?
Less painful.
Less painful.
And harmful economically to the farms.
Absolutely, yeah. Totally harmful. Exactly.
So for context, I think most people listening will know the context, but that part of the province, there's a lot of forage production, so therefore heavy irrigation.
Heavy irrigation.
Albeit some of the farmers in the midst of all this have pointed out how much they've invested in more efficient irrigation.
Yes.
But heavy irrigation.
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much. And if a large proportion of your business is based on forage irrigation, the amount of loss can be quite substantial. Mm. I was talking with a producer this morning on the Solom River in Courtney, but he produces a lot of hay. He grows a lot of his own feed. He estimates that he had a $200,000 loss last year because his water was shut off.
I see. I didn't know which loss you were talking about. So you're talking about economic loss when you suddenly have to stop watering at crucial times.
When he went through the various government programs that are available, agri-stability, crop insurance, he's been given $67,000 back.
Okay.
You were at the meeting in Falkland. You heard some of the
Westworld.
You heard some of the grievances, and that's what producers are feeling, is that they were ordered by the government to shut down, and the government is not compensating them nearly to the losses they sustained from a direct government order.
Okay, so let's go back a couple months. Because I interrupted you. You said what. Your contention is what didn't happen is that the government could have approached them a little earlier because they could have seen the writing on the wall and say, can we reduce the friction of what we think's coming? We need to make a plan.
Yes.
And your findings are that didn't happen.
Absolutely did not. So there was a series of meetings in the fall that I went to after the problems, where various government people began to say, well, this is actually how we figured it out. This is the science we used. Here's the graph of the water flows in the river. This is when we put the order in. This is when we're looking at the fish. This is why we did what we did. Mm-hmm. And then here's an opportunity to respond to that. That never happened, particularly on the Salmon River. So people felt like, even though they had the warning of the voluntary reduction orders, they felt like that was the only warning they had. Mm-hmm. So I've heard many, many people say, you know, if they had sat down and given this information 6 weeks ago, we wouldn't have felt so put upon.
Right. And then to add to that, I know it has been a real bone of contention, just the way that these orders had to be delivered. I mean, you had these officers, representatives of whatever ministry was overseeing this, showing up with, I want to be careful not to engage in like needless hyperbole or just like throwing fuel on a fire of tension. Right. But the reality is it was people in bulletproof vests showing up. And I understand why. I wouldn't mind wearing a bulletproof vest if I have to go on a farmer's land and shut their water off. But I was at the Westold meeting and I got some of the farmers I identified I really wanted to talk to. After the meeting, they were all in like really tight knit groups, and I didn't go and approach them because I was a chicken, because they were doing their own thing and catching up.
I know the feeling.
But I did go and talk to a couple of women who were, I would put to be, in their 70s or even 80s. They called me over. They just were curious who I was. And both of their families had been in that part of, have been on farms around Westwold. For one of them, it went back, their family went as far back as the 1800s. And they both were on their respective properties when these officers showed up. And one of them described that, like, she was scared, you know, someone showed up, knocked on the door, but then went around and around the house, just looking around, and she's in there and she was talking to her, whether it was, I guess, her son, whoever the younger generation was that did the farming in her family, and they were advising her not to open the door. You know, it's not a good look, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Not a good look. And particularly in some instances, there were police cars at the end of the driveway as well to back them up. So natural resource officers, NROs, have the authority, legislative authority, to go onto your property. Mm-hmm. They do not have legislative authority to go into your house. You need an RCMP search warrant to do that.
And just to clarify, I'm not saying they went in, just that they were probably wanting to communicate with someone.
Yeah.
But there was at least one little old lady, or not little old lady, but old lady, who was feeling really nervous about it.
Exactly. And my understanding is that the top users, the people known to irrigate the most and have the licenses that consume the most water, natural resource officers went to their property to ensure that they received the notice. Mm-hmm. Other people they were mailed to, I do not know if there were some registered letters involved, but I actually have been told by someone who is a supervisor of a commodity that she was told by her neighbor. Her neighbor was told to tell her that she had to shut her water off. Mm-hmm. It went by well license, but it also went by creek watershed. So this particular woman who was told, the creek that she uses was on the list. But there was confusion, well, because she couldn't find her well number on the list. So it was this whole mix-up of, like, you know, who's going on, what's going on. So again, back in July, this meeting should have taken place. This is the procedure we're going to follow. There may be an NRO coming down your...
Prepare them.
You will be required to shut off if you have a license. You were required to shut off if you're on a particular creek. And again, this is the information we have. This is why we're telling it to you. Because everyone I have heard speak about any of the catch-up meetings they had in the fall, why didn't they tell us this in July? The other thing they did not do is they didn't ask for anybody's help. So producers have said to me, yeah, I water my forage, it's like grass, but I don't have to water it all the time. Mm. And so they have told me that if producers, particularly the salmon, could have got together and put up their own watering schedule, they may have not had to have such a catastrophic situation. So you cut your lawn, the first 2 or 3 days after you cut your lawn, you water it, and it starts to grow again. And hay is the same way. But if your hay or your lawn is 6 or 8 inches high, you can leave it.
Mm-hmm.
It won't grow anymore, but it won't die.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something at least there for maybe in the fall when you're allowed to turn it back on. But if everybody is shut down at all different stages, it doesn't have to happen that way. My understanding is that on the Coxsackie River, there is a producer group that gets together like that. So why couldn't the government have said, hey, this is what's going on in Duncan. Why don't we help you to get together to do the same thing on the Salmon River?
Another element here is that certainly at the time, and I would argue even still to this day, the farmers, the general consensus among the residents, particularly the farmers, is they don't accept the scientific assertion that there is a direct relationship between the deep aquifers they're drawing from. So for context, 200 plus feet deep, their wells are drawing from a deep aquifer, a direct relationship between their collective use of that aquifer, you know, during heavy watering season and surface levels in the Salmon River. In other words, you're here to try and get more water in the Salmon River to allow the salmon to spawn. We don't believe that when we draw from that far down that you can have a meaningful impact.
Exactly.
I was at the Westhold meeting. It was an interesting situation because clearly the ministries that were attending, which was Walrus and Ag, were there to listen. And so they had hydrologists there ready to go through all the data. They never got there because the priority was if the people who have come from the community want to just ask questions, that's what we're doing. Yeah. So yes. I guess I want to ask you about that element is where do you sit or where have you come down on this disagreement over the pretty crucial set of facts?
I'm not a hydrologist either, but I've read three different reports which say exactly the same thing. So in 1994, there was a Salmon River Roundtable, and they sat down and studied and wrote a 115-page report and said, this is what we come up with and this is what we recommend. And what they said back in 94 was that forage is the biggest use of water. They also said back in 94, the wells should be licensed so we know what's going on. And the third thing they said is, we don't know what's going on.
Okay.
We don't know what the term they use is the water bank.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how much water is in the valley. They do not know the relationship between surface water, groundwater, and aquifers. They don't even know where it goes. I have read a line in that report that suggests that some of the groundwater, perhaps aquifer, I'm not sure of the exact term, may end up in O'Keefe Ranch and into the Okanagan system. They don't know.
But that's 1994.
That's 1994.
Okay.
So within the last 5 years, a similar report has been done on the Solon River and a similar report has been done on the Coxsackie River. And they say exactly the same thing. We have to have an idea of how much water we have and where it's going, where it's coming from and where it's going. So to me, my understanding is, and the government has said this in some of their publications as well, and it's actually in the recommendations of going into the watershed plan with the Cowichan tribes, is that one of their top objectives is to figure out how all the water fits together.
Okay, so here's the thing though. In Westwold, the hydrologists who were up in front of the room, so the question did come up
Yes. Exactly
about this question.
Yes.
And they said, we have slides right here. We're gonna show you that we're gonna take you through the data that we have from all the well data gathering sites in this part of the province. We can show you there is a relationship. So they kept claiming first of all, they're making the assertion it is the case.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's no trust, right, between these two groups, between the government, which we'll get to in a minute. But I didn't get to see the evidence because they just didn't get to it because the priority was let's let the residents take this wherever they want to go. So they'd get three slides in and then it would get diverted, whatever. So meanwhile, I'm supposed to be granted an interview with a subject expert this week from the Ministry of Walrus. So I can ask those questions.
Yes.
I have invited them to take me through the data. So we'll see if they come through. So it's just interesting. You're pointing out that you're highlighting past reports that have said, we don't know, right? These hydrologists were in the room saying, yes, we can show you we can show you that when you all collectively use your wells, it actually has a measurable impact in a, mm-hmm. in a short time frame on the river. I want to say that out loud because that's what they're claiming actively, which contradicts your point of view a little bit. That's all.
But it may be true, but the unfortunate thing is they did not share that in April, May, June, July, August.
Last year, that's what something the farmers have said all along is they kept saying it was the case. We kept saying we've lived here for our whole lives and we don't see a relationship. Show us the data. They did not.
I had a conversation with a fellow I know quite well at the August meeting in Westwold, the first one that kind of erupted. And he said, well, I have a 200-foot well, and it's nowhere near down low as I would be concerned about it. So, they have test wells, and they've had, there was a study done in the Westwold area of the relationship between groundwater, and they'd had test wells, and they monitored them. I know it's there. I can go back and look at my notes, see if I can find a better reference for you. But they did do a study, and the irrigators claim that that particular study doesn't match what, because they went onto people's property and said, okay, you're irrigating, let's monitor it, let's see what the result is, and the people that were part of the study said it didn't make any difference. So
I've seen one farmer who's been kind of active in voicing displeasure and resistance to the approach of the government last year, suggesting that this was about politics. This was about, we have to be seen to be doing something for the salmon. I don't know if you care to comment at all on that point of view, but I'm going to ask you if you have any comments about that.
Well, to me, it's punitive. Again, it's not providing any solutions. It's not coming to the table with anything other than we'll shut you down and that'll fix the problem. We've had salmon declines in the province for years, years and years and years. The concept of stream rehabilitation has been around for at least 100 years. We know what to do to fix the stream. And again, the Salmon River Roundtable Report, the Solom River Report, and the Coxsackie Report all say the same things. We have to have headwater storage, so we have an ability to release water later on in the summer to support the natural flows. We have to do things like stream bank rehabilitation so the sediment doesn't fall in. We have to put down in shade trees so that'll cool out of the stream. We know that if there's been logging in a watershed, then the spring freshet will be more severe and that will do more bank scouring. So we've got to be looking at that. Perhaps we're looking at some hatchery supplementation. We have a lot of tools that we can use that are in numerous studies, but we're simply not doing it right now. We're just shutting people down.
And as for all those tools, that was another theme of the night when I was in Westwold on February 27th, was a lot of hands going up saying, pointing fingers at the government saying, dereliction of duty. Like for years and years now, we've ignored a responsibility or a collective duty to manage way up high in the top of the watershed or stream bank management or whatever. Yeah.
And I say the same thing, and I asked DFO, because I was researching how many salmon were involved in this particular catastrophe, and they said about 1,500, about 500 Chinook, 500 sockeye, and 500 coho coming into the river to spawn. And they've been looking at this river since 1994, and in 1994, I think there was 2,000 or 2,500 fish, mm-hmm. not the 200,000 that report referenced happened 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we've known that this river is in crisis for a long time. And I asked how much money the DFO had spent on the river, and they couldn't tell me.
Okay, I want to move on past Westwold to generalities again, but this is not all that fair to you, but like, first of all, do you think there's any science some of these farmers could see that would convince them of a relationship between the deep aquifer wells and the surface? Like, what is your sense of their positioning around this and their willingness to embrace it if they see it? Because they've demanded to see the data. Do you think it would make a difference?
I think it would make a difference to some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how you start. You win is the wrong word. You improve the understanding of one or two or three key people, and then they begin to believe that it's positive. And how do you see, the unfortunate thing is when you lose trust, it takes 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times as long to build that trust back up again. And so it's going to be a long road to haul.
Yeah, and that's the other element of this I wanted to bring up before we move on, is that it's clearly not lost on ag and on walrus that the decision-making last year can't be repeated. Like, it was a disaster in a few different ways. And so we've been criticizing them. I want to emphasize that what I saw in Westwold, and this is one of like many, many, like a few dozen water management meetings they're now holding around
yes.
the province.
Yes.
Is they recognize that they need to change their approach
yes.
and work on trust and cooperation.
And I agree with you. I'm not sure I've heard the exact words, "we mishandled this," mm-hmm. but certainly that's the underlying intention of why they're there. They want to make amends.
I did want to ask you about upper watershed management and dams,
yes.
Et cetera. What else can you tell me about, I don't know, what you've learned about what's possible, and can you be more specific about the resources involved?
Yes. Well, there's a difference between possibility and practicality and cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if we took the Solon, which is the most recent one I've been speaking about, there is a dam on Wolf Lake, which is one of the headwater storage areas of the Solon River. It is, my understanding, it's owned by Department of Fisheries and Oceans,
mm-hmm.
and it's there to regulate the flows for fish in that particular river. But right now, the dam isn't high enough. The water scarcity is such that they need a higher dam to store more water.
At higher elevation, you mean?
Yeah, higher elevation dam. Now, rebuilding a dam is incredibly expensive. The other difficulty is we have quite strict, not necessarily onerous, depending on what your point of view is. If I live below a dam, I would like it to be onerous, but it's also strict, that there are very, very high regulations now in terms of the consequences of an accident happening for a dam. So dams are classified by the consequences of if they fail, what would happen. So a foot and a half, 2 foot high bank is a low consequence dam, and anything over 20 feet is a higher consequence dam. So there's cost, there's private land, and there's regulations now.
Right.
So
also it's just not a quick fix, right? We can't just bash up. I mean, you're kind of getting at that, but you can't just bash these things up.
No. And when you look at the Coke Sala plan, they've gone through every possibility of what they could do. Can we build storage containers? Can we look at rock quarries where people have emptied out a huge volume of rock? Can we fill those up with water? Can we even tap some of the water out of Cowichan Lake, which is an adjacent watershed, and run it through
over
the Coke Sala River? Yeah. And it's just, ask the Americans how that kind of system works. But so they've looked at all these different possibilities. The other complicating factor, particularly with the Cowichan or the Coke Sala that I understand, is that there are different areas in the headwaters are sacred places to the First Nations people. So again, we can't move in with 37 bulldozers and build a 100-foot dam.
So this all, I mean, look, in this province, we haven't necessarily come even close to the worst decisions, like the hardest decisions in terms of, like, we just may have way worse drought to come.
Yes,
right?
We may.
So have you thought about some of the, like, the hardest choices we might have to make as a province, as a citizenry?
Well, first of all, I think we have to value agriculture. And I don't hear that we're doing that. So the Cowichan, the Koksala River now is embarking in the first watershed plan in the province, the official plan. Mm-hmm. And although 30% of the land in the Koksala watershed is agricultural land and 67% of the water use is for agriculture, agriculture is not at the main discussion table. They're not at the head table. This is a government to government, a First Nations to provincial government discussion and planning process. And there isn't anything wrong with the government to government process, but the fact that agriculture has such a lower level input, they get to look at and add comments to whatever has been developed in the plan. They're not.
So why, and why, how would you characterize why that is? Why is agriculture not getting that level of
priority? Same reason that the funding per capita in the province for agriculture in BC is the lowest of any province in Canada. Agriculture is not a high priority for this government.
It was interesting. I was at a completely unrelated meeting the other night, and there was a presentation that, you know, just zoomed out on the province, like a literal map of the province, and showed how much land agriculture took up in our province. And it is grains of, not quite grains of sand in a bucket, but it's really not a lot. I mean, no. It's like 4% of the land base, yeah, compared to, you think of a province like the Saskatchewan, say.
Right. Yeah. We always come out short of forestry, and perhaps given the percentage of land, perhaps it's realistic or it's not realistic. I can't say that, but I would like, as a person living in the province, to maximize our land use, which we're required to do because we're restricted by the Agricultural Land Reserve. I would like to see that maximized. I would like to see...
At the expense of what, though? Doesn't that imply there, like, when we're managing a scarce resource, where do we make the cuts, per se?
Luckily, I don't have to make that decision.
I just say that to underscore how difficult these decisions are.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I drive through, say, Grand Forks, and I look at the bare, vacant, barren land in that area that I believe is agricultural land reserve, and nobody's farming on it. Mm. It's just, we in North America pay probably one of the lowest percentages of our income for food of anywhere in the world. We just, North Americans don't value food. We should spend money on. We want the cheapest food, the quickest and easiest and the simplest way. And yes, we have a buy local program where we did in the provincial government and we're trying to incentivize it, but it's not a priority for many people in the province.
Do you think, this is a bit oversimplified, but I'm having fun here. I mean, yeah. But how do we choose? Do we have to choose? Are there going to be watersheds where we have to choose food or fish? I realize fish are food, but you know what I'm asking you.
I think we might, and that bothers me. So a bit of a tangent here, but the cattlemen have been trying to get livestock water regulations in place at least since 2016, but before that, in terms of if I have range, which we have a lot of in the province, and my cattle are on that, how do I get assurances that I'm allowed to water them, that I can either take the water out of a stream, I can even, in some instances, go into the stream and use it for watering, or I know a lot of guys that put in gravity-fed pipes from a creek higher up and put a trough down, like literally several kilometers down the hill to water their livestock. What are the regulations around that? What's the playing field going to look like? How much money am I going to have to pay for a license? That kind of thing. The government has refused to put those in place. Cattlemen said, can we have it in the Water Sustainability Act? Government said, now we'll put it in regulations. Mm-hmm. Cattlemen said, okay, if it's in regulations, what can we have? So they put it on intentions paper. They put out a what we heard. Nobody liked what they heard, so they've put it aside and they said, we're going to negotiate it in a watershed plan. So what happens if everyone in Kelowna sits down at the watershed plan and says, no, we don't like cattle in this watershed? And there's only maybe two or three livestock operations. Mm-hmm. They could be told to leave. The collective ability of the people at the table could say, no, we don't want you here. That's a major business hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we can coexist.
But sure, you believe and hope that we can coexist. But back to like hard decisions. In some contexts, is the cheapest option going to be to essentially buy out the people that have to be like the losers in the water fights?
It might be, but it's, if they're committed to doing that and committed to a fair market value, it's a water-related problem, but it's not the same. But the town of Grand Forks has been flooded several times, mm-hmm. between the Granby and the what's that other river? And they actually expropriated land that was on a low-level area, which was continually flooded. And they said, listen, this is a dumb place. It used to be a wetland. We filled it in. We put houses on it. It's a dumb place for houses. It gets flooded every year. We will give you guys the option of, and we will give you some compensation. And of course, it was an argument. I mean, obviously, you've lived that area three years of continually flooding. What's the market value of your house? Well, it's not very much, but it might actually, 5 years ago, it might have been worth something. But we'll give you some incentive to move. We'd like you to move. And then the 10 guys that still stayed, they expropriated it. They paid them out because they said, this is ridiculous. We have to change. So I'm not overly privy to how that happened, and I haven't heard horror stories about how it happened, but I'm sure they are. But the I believe it was the capital or the regional district that said, we got to fix this problem. And so they did. So they're putting in a wetland again. They're restoring it. So a community group did make a decision. The people that they elected made the decision that we would change this. And so I think it can be done.
Okay, Tom, well, we could go on and on, but we won't. So I've led this conversation. I just want to end by saying anything we didn't cover that you want to say while we're talking.
Okay, yes. So as I mentioned, the province is undertaking government to government watershed plans officially. But there's also an ability for a local area to develop their own water sustainability plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the government to government process. My understanding that there is one in place for in the Nicola Valley. There is actually a water sustainability plan in place for the city of Kelowna. And Lake District is beginning to develop their own. And I think it's really important that we're aware of that, that if we hear that there's anything to do with water planning going on in our area, that we show up, we talk about it, we make ourselves heard. Because if we don't do that, the government will do it for us, which is kind of part of their job.
Mm-hmm.
But so I hear that people on the Salmon River are meeting together. They're bringing in government people on their own, not saying, let's go to a government meeting. They're being proactive.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers feel like it's an extra burden to them. It's being done on their backs because they were the ones that shut down. So they're the ones that are getting together to see if they can fix the problem rather than waiting for the government to fix the problem. But I think that's very, very essential. That if you hear about it, go and listen, go and talk about it.
Yeah, it seems like a corollary to feelings of resentment or that the government is being too intrusive is that unfortunately you've got to, everyone, the people that feel that way, the people of a community, need to be willing to put in some tough work.
Yes.
If they want to wrest at least some control of this, of these hard decisions, these management issues.
And I hear all the time that the vote in the province stops at Hope. And I haven't looked at a boundary distribution or a percentage of who voted for what lately, but certainly people outside of the Lower Mainland definitely feel that they don't have a voice in the decision making, and the decisions are being made for them, and again, often on their backs. And so our only recourse at this particular time is to show up and be heard.
Tom Walker, thanks very much.
Okay, so that was Tom's take on the topic. I also spoke with Minister of Water, Land and Resource Stewardship, Nathan Cullen, who offered to speak with me when I requested an interview with a hydrologist from Walrus so that I could ask them to take me through some data that they say demonstrates that when farmers around Westwold collectively pull irrigation water from wells deep under the Salmon River, that it affects levels in the river. I made the request close to 3 weeks ago, and I've checked in a couple of times, and a spokesperson with Walrus continues to tell me that they're working on it. But anyway, here's my conversation with Minister Nathan Cullen.
I'm just going to let you know I'm pressing record on my recorder here.
You bet.
And, okay, well, essentially, I'm producing some materials, audio for audio broadcast about the general drought conditions in British Columbia and what this might mean for irrigation rights and privileges, et cetera, for farmers in the province. I've been focusing on Westwold because it's in my area and because, well, probably for obvious reasons to you as well. So I have some questions related to Westwold, and I think I can probably cram most of it in 10 minutes. We'll see how we do.
Yeah, let's give it a shot.
Okay, sure. Thank you so much. Minister, if you or your colleagues, really I'm talking about those members of the BC government that oversee all of these issues we have around water allocation, including Ministry of Walrus, if you had a do-over, is there anything you think officials or civil servants would have done differently when we think about Westwold and what had to be done around managing water levels there last year?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing us do now in talking to communities like Westwold and many others around the province, led primarily by Ministry of Agriculture, is to have those conversations early and often, well ahead of any potential drought. We know the snowpack numbers are worrisome again this year, which means we're likely headed to potential drought in many regions in BC. And the best way to attack this very difficult problem is together. We know there's not one order of government that can solve all of this, that it's right down to the individual, down to the farmer, local government, on up the chain. We know that we have an incredibly difficult challenge when we get down to water scarcity, because it's so critical to so much of our industry, to our very well-being, and to the health of our rivers and salmon that are in them. So we've had some conversations already, I believe, in Westfold and Salmon Arm and a number of the interior communities, as well as throughout the province. We've stood up a significant amount of money to help work with farmers to fund the specific projects that we know will help with drought, holding water back on the land, and stay humble, because this is a very, very difficult challenge. And it is, again, one that we have to tackle together.
Right. And so some subtext I get out of that, and also just in my observations around the community, like I attended the February 27th water meeting in Westwold. It's just that they're one consequence of the abruptness of some of the decisions that had to be made last year is that there seems to me to be a real lack of trust. And I'm just wondering if you agree, and if so, how, in addition to what you just told me, how the government intends to improve relationships, specifically trust between the government and those communities.
Sure. Yeah. And I wasn't at that meeting in February, but my understanding from people who were there, including staff and some farmers, was it was a much better spirit of it, that there was respect just with the idea of being in the community in advance, understanding what the challenges that we face and what kind of choices and concessions can we make together in advance of drought. Are there projects and permits that we have to start moving now that will allow us to keep water on the land longer? And that ultimately this is a community conversation. The good news is that we have a number of water tables around the province where First Nations, farmers, biologists, people who deal with hydrology sit throughout the year, in fact, and have in some cases for decades now, where the understanding when there is scarcity, when the scarcity is every season, that the solutions that come up from the community are always, almost in every case, better than ones that are imposed from on top. It is also important to look at the way the laws are in our province, and that there are challenging times and we are directed by those laws when the water gets too low. But we want to do everything we can to be respectful, to take the answers and solutions from community, and to bring people into the conversation. Because again, this is a collective challenge. There's no way to, I think, properly address it just by leaving one group off on their own to try to sort it out. This is something we have to do together, from municipalities right on to the private sector and the government as a whole.
So you mentioned the laws that we are governed by, and that relates to another question I had for you, which is, we do have to be making, during times of drought, really tough decisions, but I am wondering how the government effectively triages some competing water demands. And I'm going to put it really plainly. In situations where it comes down to, like it did in Westwold last summer, fish versus forage,
Are fish always going to come first? Is that effectively, is that what you mean when we have laws that we're governed by?
Yeah, the folks that have to make the call, it's not typically we get advice up from staff. The law is very clear in the Water Sustainability Act that conservation, particularly if there's an endangered salmon species or a stock that we're dealing with, we have to try to keep the river as watered as possible. What I would say with respect to that tension between things like losing a salmon population in a river or stream, a farmer's trying to draw water, is that what we heard from and are hearing from farmers again and again is timing is everything. Respectful conversations way in advance matter a lot because decisions can get made by the farmer, can be made by public officials well in anticipation if we suspect that drought is likely facing us again. So when a crop gets put down, when it's watered, when the harvest comes, these are all things that the Ministry of Agriculture and our ministry, the Ministry of Water, are talking with each other and is as importantly or more importantly, talking to farmers, talking to the stream biologists that'll tell us, well, this is that second week in August or the third week of stage five drought. That's the moment where we have our greatest challenge. Knowing that in advance allows us to anticipate where the concessions have to happen and hopefully keep people together in this struggle that we have. Are there certain parts of our region that are more prone? Can we set up the agriculture projects with farmers, the dams, the holding back water, any of those options? Let's talk about them now in the wintertime, build the projects through spring if we can, so that when we face those significant challenges come summer and fall, that we're much better equipped when we were last year.
Right. And so am I right in assuming though, so I agree with you or I grant that with better planning and working together, we can have to make less hard decisions in those challenging moments. But ultimately, if we're talking about laws, are full restrictions or curtailments of irrigation on the table, like as a tool that we may have to use in 2024?
Yeah, looking at the snowpack levels, one would anticipate that we're going to have drought again in certain regions of BC. I'm asking our teams to triage where the most likely. I mean, this is a hard thing to predict also, because if you can predict the rain and the snow and the temperature, then you're much smarter than me. But there's just a precautionary approach that given the years we've recently experienced, could we anticipate drought again? We can. Could there be curtailments? Well, there would for almost certain if we don't do anything about it. So let's triage. Let's find out where the regions that are most at risk, stand up the projects, the dams, the water projects that we know are going to help, and lower the risk as much as we possibly can so that we don't have to curtail anyone's water unless absolutely necessary, and that we make those decisions as much more together as communities than we do just, you know, a dictate from a faceless person in Victoria. This is a localized conversation. We need to have people involved. This is a very local challenge. Of course, it's also a global one. Our glaciers are diminishing. This is a usual amount of source of good cold water. It comes down. It's really critical times of year. We in BC have not typically had this problem. Droughts have been historically short and very regional specific. But to our neighbors in the south and, in fact, to the east, they've been dealing with drought for many, many generations. And BC is challenged because a lot of the laws that we have on the books only anticipate drought being a localized and short-term function. We're taking all sorts of advice from colleagues in other jurisdictions, the states and other provinces, to make sure that we have the right tools in the toolkit, even though, again, historically, this has not been that same scope of challenge for BC. But we have, in the Northeast right now, we have communities that are in stage five drought and never left, went right through the winter, all the way through the winter in a drought level and may not come out. This is where you've got really hard choices to make between industry and local government. So the hopefulness, again, goes back to, do we have the relationships? Do we have the insight from local water users? Do we have good licensing of groundwater users? Because if you can't measure a thing, it's very difficult to manage the thing. And we've got a lot of work to do on the licensing front just to bring people in and restore, I think, some of that trust that you talked about being lost in the last season. And I think we're approaching it in a much more respectful way this year. And I think it gives us a better chance of dealing with these challenges together.
One more quick question, if possible, sure. Minister. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah.
It's just around, in the conversations I've had in these communities, one point being made is just that I think everyone understands that curtailments may have to happen for the reasons that you've outlined. Some of those same people don't believe that past levels of compensation for farmers in those situations are adequate. I'm wondering if there's any plans to ensure that where farmers take a significant economic hit, there'll be better compensation for them.
Yeah, we've stood new compensation regimes up. I would have to work with my colleague, the Minister of Agriculture, to fully understand where the gaps are. How is it that we compensate? But we've been modifying everything from the way we pay people to help us deal with wildfires to the effects on timber losses through forest fire. So this whole regime, and we knew this, we've known this about climate change for a long time, that avoiding climate change is expensive, but adapting to climate change is far more expensive and far more harmful. This is just one more example of the cost to the broader public, because there's one taxpayer and we're all trying to deal with a very serious issue. So again, it sort of circles me back to why we have to make sure we're doing everything we can on our climate change efforts so that we're dealing with less of these very difficult and sometimes expensive decisions.
Minister Cullen, thank you so much for giving me some time to talk about this.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime. Appreciate it.
Minister, now just human to human, citizen to citizen, I simultaneously believe that the government needs to be accountable to its decisions, but also that this is a really tough set of decisions. You know, I don't envy you in this portfolio. It's tough. It's really tough.
It is. But a lot of people want to harken back to maybe older times when we had that more localized together effort. And I think we have to find that sweet spot between with the power of a provincial government, a federal government, but also the intelligence and the togetherness of when you're talking neighbor to neighbor. Because in Nicola Valley, Coxsala, different places where water tables have been very successful, it's just easier to have the hard conversations in January than it is in September.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I hope you have a great day, and I hope
Thanks.
I get to interview you sometime again.
Yeah, of course.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Minister Mr. Cullen. Bye-bye. All right. That's the end of the episode. Thanks for listening. Please check back here soon for more long-form conversations with peoples from BC's agriculture sector. If you have suggestions for future guests of the show, I'm all ears. podcast@farminginbc.ca. Finally, if you're a farmer in BC, remember, we have a lot more in common than all our differences would suggest. Okay, I'm Jordan Marr, and I'll talk to you next time.